From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. In the Jewish sacred calendar, the holiest day of the year is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, a day for fasting and praying, repenting and forgiving, ideas at the heart of many religious traditions.
The question is, what are the limits of forgiveness in my life? Can we forgive whatever our notion of God is for all the hardships in our lives, alongside all the blessings? How do we begin with forgiving ourselves?
Jewish or non-Jewish, religious or secular, forgiveness is something we all struggle with. Today, reinterpreting Yom Kippur and the journey to forgiveness. But first, what does it take to forgive?
I spent most of my 20s traveling around the world with a backpack to places like Afghanistan and Iraq, and then ultimately in the summer of 2008 into Somalia for what I thought was going to be a one-week work trip into the most dangerous country in the world. And of course, it was a trip that would change the course of my life forever.
In 2008, Canadian journalist Amanda Lindhout was captured by a gang of Somali kidnappers. She and her Australian colleague Nigel Brennan were held hostage for more than a year. Amanda was starved, raped, and tortured during her time in captivity, and it is not easy for her to talk about what she endured. But she has written a memoir called A House in the Sky, and she sat down recently to talk with Anne Strainchamps about what she believes kept her alive. Forgiveness. This is her story.
On our third day in the country, Nigel and I set out to visit the internally displaced people's camp that we had come to the country to see. And as we did so, we rounded a sort of bend in a road, and we could see there was a car pulled over off to the side up ahead. And as we got closer, about a dozen armed men, all of their faces wrapped in checkered scarves, emerged from where they had been hiding behind that vehicle, and they were all holding AK-47s pointed at ours. And the next thing I knew, I found myself lying face down in the dirt, spread eagle, with a gun held to the back of my head.
Did you realize right away what was going on?
I think it's difficult in a moment like that to accept the reality of what is happening. So it took, in fact, a couple of weeks before the truth of the situation really dawned on me, and I really began to accept that I was a hostage and that this was not going to be over anytime soon.
So in the meantime, you entered this incredibly long, well, in the end, you were in captivity for more than 400 days. What were the physical conditions like?
The physical conditions changed over the course of time. Things really changed at about the five-month mark, when Nigel and I were beginning to feel very desperate, and we planned and executed an escape. And following that failed escape attempt, things changed for us both. Everything changed.
How did you even manage to plan an escape? Because at that point, you were kept separately and you weren't allowed to communicate at all.
Our captors had grown lazy. Nigel and I had devised secret ways to communicate with each other when our kidnappers weren't paying close attention. And it was during one of these secret conversations that Nigel pointed out he thought we might have a chance to escape out a bathroom window. It was a bathroom that only he and I used. There was bricks cemented across the front of it, but the house that we were held in, it was old, and the mortar that held those bricks in place was crumbling. And so with a pair of nail clippers that our kidnappers had given us, we took turns sneaking into that bathroom and digging away at that crumbling mortar until we were finally able, after a few days of doing this, to remove a couple of those bricks and jump out a hole about the size of a basketball. And our plan was to run to a nearby mosque where we hoped that we would find some help.
And did you?
Well, of course, it wasn't long before our kidnappers discovered we were missing. We had made some noise when we jumped out the window, and they tracked us to the mosque. the most profound moment of that day and a moment that I carry with me now through and will through the rest of my life is the incredible bravery and courage of a Somali woman who risked and may have lost her life that day trying to help me, a woman who entered the mosque in the middle of this chaotic scene, who was dressed in the full Islamic hijab and niqab, and she came directly over to me and she embraced me and she called me her sister and she began pleading with my captors to let me go. And of course, they had no patience for her interference, so they grabbed me by my ankles and began towing me by them across the floor of the mosque towards the door where there was a truck waiting to take me away. But this woman, she hung on to me and she threw her body on top of mine and did everything she could to protect me. And in the end, she was not ultimately able to prevent my kidnappers from putting me in the truck and then everything that happened afterwards.
How did thinking about her, I mean, did you keep thinking about her?
You know, I was faced with, every single day I was faced with unthinkable abuse, and the conditions were so terrible that it was really difficult not to slide into absolute despair. And there were whole days that I lost in that state of despair. But the longer that I was held, I realized that by allowing myself to go there and allowing my mind to just cycle through those despairing thoughts, which sounded like, why me, or I'll never make it out of here, I was also contributing to my own suffering. And that if I could catch those thoughts when they started to spin through my head, which they were always doing, and replace them with thoughts like, I will be free, I will go home, I choose freedom, I choose peace, and then later, too, I choose forgiveness, that helped me stay above the very dark black pit of despair that I was always trying to fight against going back into. So that's when I really started dreaming about one day being able to create an organization to help, and an organization that would also in large part be to honor the woman at the mosque.
Were you able ever to actually feel any forgiveness at all for your captors?
Forgiveness is, it's such a, I have been working on this process of forgiveness now for years. It's really, for me, as I experience it, not something that happens all at once. Like, you make the choice to forgive, and then that means there's no anger left inside of you. I chose then, as I choose now, every single day, to forgive my kidnappers for what they did to me. And some days I get closer to that than other days, but it is really and truly something that I choose every single day as part of my healing process. And it is my greatest hope, I guess, that one day that will be a state that I live in all of the time.
How did you and Nigel wind up getting free eventually?
Our kidnapping was always about money. Nigel and I had very, very little information in the rooms that we were held in about everything that was going on the other side and the other parts of the world, the extraordinary efforts of both of our families to sell homes and raise money. So our freedom came as a great surprise. And the next day, I was flown out to a hospital in Kenya where I was reunited with my mom, which was such a purely joyful moment. But the truth is that it took weeks for the reality of this new freedom to really settle in. Freedom had been something I had dreamed about for so long. And then now that I was actually experiencing it, what it felt like was a dream. And I still have days that it's hard to, like, fully understand that I am free, because I think once freedom has been taken away from you, and for as long as it was for me, maybe there's a part of me that will always stay there, that will feel not entirely free.
You've been back to Somalia several times since then. I guess I find that remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I came home from that experience, I never thought that I would go back to Somalia. But as I've said, I had this idea to create these educational initiatives within Somalia. You know, it was, as I've said, it was not easy to make the choice to go back. But I suppose by facing that, one of my greatest fears, and doing that with the motivation being to help others, there was some healing in that for me. I faced one of my greatest fears, and I came out stronger for it. And that's something that I'm grateful for.
Amanda, thank you so much for your courage in telling the story and for the work that you're doing.
Thanks.
Amanda Lindhout's nonprofit Global Enrichment Foundation supports aid and education for women in Somalia and Kenya. Her memoir, written with Sarah Corbett, is called A House in the Sky. She talked with Anstrang Champs. Forgiveness lies at the heart of just about every religious tradition. Buddhist compassion, Christian redemption, and the Jewish cycle of atonement or repentance, celebrated on Yom Kippur. Amichai Lau-Lavi leads services at New York's experimental Lab Shul. During this year's High Holy Days, he's been thinking about the words we use.
I think the word repentance, first of all, is a loaded and baggaged one for many of us, and the word I prefer is return, which is perhaps a more accurate translation of the Hebrew word teshuvah, which is indeed at the heart of this season. Teshuvah could be translated as return, reply, the sense of recircling and recycling and coming back to perhaps where we want to be the most. So if you look at the biblical notion of atonement and repentance and return, replace the word God with the word higher self. Replace the word repentance with the word return. And you've got a very sensitive, humanistic approach to simply giving us the break we need to forgive ourselves and to do better. My invitation to myself and to people in my life has been for quite a few years now to use this time of year, this precious season of transition from summer into the fall, as an opportunity to take stock of life, my body, my thoughts, my house, my relationships, and begin the year with a fresh start and a clean slate, if possible. The term High Holy Days is a very weird translation of the Hebrew Yamim Noraim, which could be the days of awe, or the terrible days, or the awesome days. I remember probably in my early teens being in synagogue with my father, you know, in the men's section, and outside the window of that synagogue in Jerusalem was some kind of a sculpture in the nearby park of a large dove that would rotate in the wind. And I remember standing there in the early part of Yom Kippur in the morning, looking out and making a deal with God, with whom even then I already had a nebulous relationship. But I remember saying, look, if you're going to make that dove turn its face toward me at some point today as it spins, that means I need to do what I need to do to be better, whatever the heck it was at 13 or 14. I'm sure it was, you know, masturbation and theft and whatever teen boys are thinking about. And just before sunset, before the end of Yom Kippur, that dove spun. And that felt magical. It was a religious moment of my own imagination. I think we are invited all the time into mystery and into our highest aspirations. We get caught up with so much of our emotions and needs and stuff, And this is the time of year to really say, what can I say goodbye to so I can say hello to something else? My attempt is to bring back the oral tradition. The first day of Rosh Hashanah is the story of the birth of Isaac, who was born to a 100-year-old Abraham and a 90-year-old Sarah. Abraham is going to be talking about the joy of having a baby at 100, but he's going to be talking about his difficulty at forgiving God for making him barren for most of his life. And so the question is, can we forgive whatever our notion of God is for all the hardships in our lives, alongside all the blessings? And one of the places where I want to examine is, how do we begin with forgiving ourselves? In Hebrew, the word sin is chet, and it literally means missing the mark. I miss the mark all year long. I've started diets that I've dropped out of. I promise to do things on a daily basis that I have not done. I've said horrible things to people. I've sent emails I should have not sent, etc., etc. Of course, I mess up. We all mess up. Question is, what can I do about it? Am I going to consider these as guilt and, you know, whip myself to tears? Or am I going to acknowledge them consciously and try and understand why this is so and what can I do better? And the process is a joyful one. It's a difficult one, but it's a joyful one. Here I am. I get to do this again.
Time evolves and comes to a place where it renews again.
Amichai Lau-Lavi is an Israeli-born Jewish educator, writer, and performer. He's the founder of Storytelling, Inc., and the spiritual leader of New York's Lab Shul.
Oh, yes, I am. I'm so sorry. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, I am. Believe me, darling, I tell you.
If you like this program, there's more online. You can share your thoughts, look for books, explore the archives at ttbook.org. Later this hour, the biology of forgiveness. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Are there limits to what we can forgive, to what we should forgive? James Dawes directs the program in Human Rights and Humanitarianism at McAllister College in Minnesota. A few years ago, he interviewed a group of war criminals from the Second Sino-Japanese War. It wasn't his first experience with accounts of atrocity, but meeting these now very old men was profoundly unsettling. Steve Paulson read Dawes' recent book about the experience, called Evil Men, and wanted to know more. And I should warn you, some of what they talked about is difficult to hear.
Jim, why did you want to talk to these old Japanese war criminals? What did you hope to learn from these conversations?
I had some anxiety about talking to them. I mean, they are some of the worst monsters in the history of the 20th century. The things they did, murder, torture, rape, medical experiments on unsedated civilians. And they did it in a kind of cunning and diabolical way over years. So I had a great deal of anxiety. But in the end, I felt like there are basically two ways of knowing evil. One is we all, looking at the news, know evil because you can't escape it. But for those of us who are lucky to live relatively safe lives, it's essentially a cognitive idea. And we have to figure out how to deal with this idea. But it's nothing that, for better, lack of a better word, hits us in the gut. I was hoping with these men to get close enough to the eyes of the perpetrator that not only maybe I could see the world through their eyes, but get close enough to perhaps see something of myself in their eyes, to understand that kind of evil more fully.
Who were these men you talked to?
So these were soldiers from the Second Sino-Japanese War. In the U.S., we generally think of this as the Second World War. And they were the ground troops. They were the people who invaded the villages. They were the people who shot the children, raped and drowned the women, distributed poisoned sweet cakes through the villages. They were the killers.
And they were, I mean, to put this in perspective, I mean, the things that they did that you write about, I mean, I have to say, this is a hard book to read.
And what was striking was how easy these were men to meet, because they are now old, and they are sweet, they're grandfathers, and they're so harmless looking. It's hard to connect them to the monsters they must have been so many decades ago.
So did you like them when you met them?
I did. And I feel awful about that. I'm haunted by this idea. You know, we'd enter, I went with a wonderful photographer named Adam Nadell, and we'd enter their homes. And when you do an interview, you're basically, you're in a relationship. And so we'd meet them, we'd meet their kids, their grandkids. We'd share food, gifts, and joke around as we warmed up for the interview. And I was just haunted by this idea of one of their victims maybe standing outside the window and looking in and seeing us bonding, really, as they told us what they did. But I couldn't help liking them. These men were near dying, and they were apologetic, and compassion is hard to resist.
And these people were all convicted as war criminals. I mean, they spent years in prison camps, and since they were released, they've had a lifetime to think about the atrocities they committed.
Yeah, so they were unique in that sense. Most perpetrators don't apologize and don't talk about it. These men were captured first, put in prison camp in Siberia, which was brutal. Most died. Depression, starvation, beating, the cold. And then they were transferred to a prison camp in China called Fushun. And there they were essentially converted. They were subjected to what they think of as spiritual re-education, what in the West we tend to think of as communist indoctrination. But they were indoctrinated to believe that murder, torture, and rape of civilians is wrong. And they were converted to a kind of evangelical pacifism. And so for the rest of their life, they spent their days trying to atone for what they did, trying to make up for what they did.
How? By telling the story?
So after they came back, they were subjected to social exile, not because they had committed these crimes, but because they spoke about them. In Japan, there was then, and still in fact remains today, a strong denial movement. Nobody wanted to admit that these things happened, that they were Japanese responsibility. And so their work, their life mission, even now in their end days, is to tell the story over and over again, to try and get people to listen, to try and counter the denial movement. And I think they felt they owed that to the victims.
Are they looking for forgiveness?
Yes. And I think frankly, many feel they've been forgiven. One of the most striking things working with perpetrators like this is that when there's a denial movement, victims and survivors want to forgive the perpetrators often. Because, I mean, just think of it this way. If you've been subjected to some terrible atrocity, your family members have been murdered or killed, or you've suffered some terrible injury, this becomes a basic fact of your psyche for the rest of your life. And if you look around the world and people are denying it happened, governments are saying it never happened, the distance between your most deeply felt internal trauma and the lies that are public history, that's a crazy-making distance. And so people live with that and they suffer from it. It's a second kind of trauma. So when a perpetrator comes forward and says, I did it, it happened, it's kind of like healing, and they're so grateful to the perpetrators for it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is also complicated because you're in a way talking about the act of confession in a religious sense almost. And I guess the question is whether we should accept their confessions given what they did.
That's a hard question. I think most of us have two common sense sort of moral philosophies about this that coexist, and we struggle with them. On the one hand, I think many of us can relate to the idea that we shouldn't be held responsible for the people we were decades ago. We have the right for a second chance. We have the right to say, I'm different from that person when I was 19 or whatever. Everyone has the right to define themselves again. And that coexists with this sense we have where you can say to someone, yeah, but what you did, you crossed a line that you can't uncross. You are now exiled from humanity. It doesn't matter how many decades pass. It doesn't matter what you do. You don't get the second chance. You don't get to tell the story of your miraculous spiritual rebirth. And you will bear responsibility until you die. And I think we have both those feelings in us often.
So this is a complicated story for you, too. I mean, it's not just about them. It's about what it means for you to, I mean, bearing witness is part of what you were doing. But I guess it's more complicated than that.
It is. And part of it is just the last thing I or anyone else who works in human rights would want to do is produce some sort of pornography of evil, some sort of sensational story I mean, these are shocking stories, but, you know, shock is a suspicious emotion. It's a superficial emotion, and the survivors deserve more than that. We deserve more than another appalling march through the carnage of history. And yet, when you tell these stories, that's part of it. And trying to get that right, to tell the truth about what happened without sensationalizing it is difficult.
So can you tell me what it was like to meet with one or two of these men? I mean, you're sitting down with them. You've had tea with them. I mean, you're sort of exchanging niceties. You know, these are very old men now. Hmm. And then they start telling you what they did. I mean, these horrible, horrible things that they did. What was that like?
It was vertigo. One of the men I was most fond of, he came out of the hospital to see us, and he was quite ill, but also really youthful and kind of funny and charming. And he was just the kind of person you had to love. And so we would slip in back and forth in these conversations between joking about his days or what we were doing in Japan, and then him going into these stories about how, for instance, he, you know, participated in killing a child by throwing a grenade in a well and drowning the child, or how he competed to chop off heads of villagers, competed to rape as many women as he could.
So how did you make sense of these stories? I mean, in some ways, what you're describing are things that we almost don't even have categories for.
This is one of the basic paradoxes of trauma like this, that on the one hand, we have this idea that you have to tell the story, that silence is a kind of another act of murder, that if you let these things erase themselves in history, you are injuring the dead once again. And so we have to put it in words. It's our moral duty. On the other hand, coexisting with this is our sense that these things do escape language. They are beyond language. When you take something like the Holocaust, say, and you put it into the normal, ordinary words we use to organize our days, to teach a class, to talk to each other, this language shrinks it, it changes it. It's almost a kind of blasphemy to take something that's ineffable, that's inexpressible, and turn it into the common stuff that we trade every day.
So given that you've thought about not just the evil itself, but how to tell the story, how to construct these narratives, what do you do with that? What do you do with the complexity here?
For a couple of years after I did these interviews, I sat with the tapes in my desk and didn't touch them because I didn't know how to approach it. And it seemed like a task destined to produce bad results, to cheapen it or to sensationalize it. And so I didn't do anything. And eventually, you know, friends of mine who work in human rights and who do war photography, they said, you just have to get over that. There is no clean escape. There's no clean moral answer to this. But you have to tell the story because the story was told to you and you have to pass it on.
One of the questions that comes out of the story is whether these men were monsters or whether they were actually not that different from us, but just caught up in a horrible system that rewarded them for demonizing the enemy and for doing these horrible things. How do you answer that?
They were very ordinary men. They were good husbands, good neighbors. One was a philosophy professor who focused on ethics. They were good people. And if they hadn't been boys born on a certain year, they would have lived out their lives just like me and you. I really believe that. There was nothing pathological about them. But they got processed by this incredibly streamlined military system that is really good at turning ordinary people into monsters. It's a standard process. We can map it out. First, you take young men, because it always has to be young men. Young men are easier to deconstruct and put back together again. The great American poet Herman Melville once said, "All wars are boyish and fought by boys." That's important. So you take these young men and you separate them from their families, from their friends, from their institutions, all those things that normally give them moral guidance. Once you've done that, then you re-educate them. You teach them that the world is binary. It's us versus them, safe versus unsafe, holy versus unholy. And then you've prepared them. They have now the proper mindset to begin to become perpetrators. After that, it's a matter of breaking them down physically through harsh military training, hazing, harsh wartime conditions. Essentially, if their days can become stressful and unpredictable enough, and they begin to feel helpless enough, they're going to crave that feeling of control. And that feeling of control comes quickest through violence and domination of another. And then the last step is that atrocity is always step by step. none of the men I met wanted to start off doing these things. None of them would have ever started off by competing to rape as many women as they could in a village or torturing children. They started off slowly. And so the first time they bayoneted, they were taught to bayonet on corpses, and that shocked them, nauseated them. But it got normal after a while. And then they were taught to bayonet captured civilians tied to trees. And this terrified them at first, but then became normal. And then eventually they were competing and arguing over what weapons they should use and doing this to civilians.
Now, one of the questions that we're dealing with is about the nature of evil, how we define evil. And this is complicated. Clearly, these men committed acts of great evil, but were they evil people themselves? I mean, you've suggested not. You've suggested they're sort of ordinary, but they were part of an evil system, which suggests that is evil always situational?
Well, I guess the first problem I have with thinking about evil is it tends to be a word that stops us from thinking. When we call something evil, typically we're trying to say it doesn't require analysis or understanding. All it requires is our judgment and our punishment. Evil is a word we use when we want to stop understanding and often start hurting another person. And so part of what I wanted to do with this book is say, you know, actually, maybe evil isn't where you stop thinking, but where you start. Maybe it's not what silences conversation, but what begins it. And I think it's true, these men, they were monsters. They describe themselves as demons in the war, and they were. And the question is, do they get to be forgiven for that? And do they get to start over again afterwards?
What did you have to figure out for yourself?
I think for me, the primary question was the question of judgment, really. The incredible attraction we have to judging others and to this need to condemn that we have, and that I certainly have, this sense of our righteousness and the sense that we owe it to the dead to judge and to condemn. And I felt that pulling me at times, but then as I've mentioned, I felt like I was distant from this. I didn't have a right to be judging people who'd been through circumstances I couldn't understand. And maybe some of it is just about that very basic animal pity that we have when you're with a man who's old and frail and dying and he's sorry and he wants you to know he's sorry before he dies. It's hard to keep anything in mind other than the kind of basic compassion that pulls out in you.
Well, thank you very much. It's a remarkable story.
Thank you.
James Dawes teaches English and directs the program in Human Rights and Humanitarianism at McAllister College in Minnesota. Steve Paulson talked with him about his book, Evil Men. You'll find photographs of some of the men they talked about on our website, ttbook.org.
I've been trying to make amends. I've been trying to choose a better path. No, I can't change what's been done, but I'll face up to it. I don't want to run.
Jimmy Barnes, Forgiveness. Someone else who's thought a lot about forgiveness is Kerry Sudler. The day he inherited the family Bible, he found recorded in the scratchy marks of a quill pen not just the births and deaths of his ancestors, but the names of the slaves they owned, including the prices paid for them. Kerry Sudler shares his last name with both black and white families in Sudlerville, Maryland, the site of the old family plantation. What do you do with a history like that? Is it even possible to apologize?
I couldn't find any record, and I don't know of any instance where my family has ever officially or formally or informally apologized to any of these people. And there are hundreds of them and hundreds of them out there, descendants. And I think it has to happen. I think it's important that if I don't do anything about this, it just continues, and a larger invisible oppression continues, and I'm a participant of it. I have to say I was a little nervous to call, because part of the reason I'm calling is that the reason that you and I probably have the same last name is not through the best circumstances in history.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just, this may sound a little weird, but I just want to apologize for any difficulty that life is as far as racism and all the rest of it. And I want to let you know that you have somebody with the same last name who's interested in having a level playing field for everybody.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate that, and certainly welcome that. So that's a good feeling that goes with that. Let me assure you there are no issues with me along those lines. Trying to understand all the things that happened, I guess it's more important to me just to try to understand, you know, what went on.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm thrilled just the fact that you called.
Your white skin gives you access to almost anything that you want. I'm followed in grocery stores and I'm followed in department stores still. Is it better? Yeah, it's better in my own lifetime. It's better. But it's not perfect. It hasn't improved. And white people still say, yeah, I have black friends, and they say that I'm not racist. But if you have to make that statement, then there must be some racism somewhere.
I really didn't know what to do, so I small-talked the guy up in the beginning and just asked him, you know, what's it like to walk around in a town with this name? It's your last name, but you're not the white guy, so maybe you don't feel the same. And he really did turn and just put it to me really brutally like that. I said, you know, I would like to apologize for the way that your life is right now and any participation that my family may have had in it in the last several hundred years in creating a world that is the way it is for you right now. That you were brought here against your will, your family, your great-great-great-great-grandfather 9 generations ago, maybe in chains, you know, maybe whatever went on that was really painful that has created a reality for him today that is so much more difficult than my reality, and needlessly so. I really don't know what you say to somebody. I mean, I wasn't given the manual or the lessons on how to do this, and I've gone it alone. And a lot of white people really resent me and think that I have no business doing this. I wasn't there. It wasn't my fault. But I carry my family's name, and I carry what it's done, both good and bad. What do? In life, you just try and do the next right thing, even if you don't understand it.
Kerry Sudler from a 2002 interview. You can hear the full story on our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
As the needle slips in the groove of an old 78 RPM disc, I'm Henry Sapoznik. You know, sometimes when you listen to these old recordings, you know you're in a studio. You kind of feel the sound of it. Other times, however, the sound takes you right to the source. It takes you right to where this sound originated. And that is what's happening here. We have now been taken to a synagogue in New York in 1907, where the cantor Isaiah Mizells, who is singing here, is blessing the congregation. This is the blessing of the priests on one of the high holy days of the Jewish New Year. May the Lord bless you and keep you, and make his face shine upon you, and show favor and give you peace. this is what it sounded like when you were sitting in the congregation and praying along with the cantor and his choir. He was called the messenger of the people, and it wasn't just the message, but it was what the message was framed in, a beautiful, articulate voice. This was an era that venerated great singing, and these cantors who learned their skills from the cantors of the previous generation brought to this moment of standing in front of the microphone the cumulative artistic skill of generations of carriers of the tradition. This sound is the exact same sound that was being heard in Jewish communities in Eastern Europe, and the sound that would sadly come to an abrupt end within a few short decades. I'm Henry Sapoznik.
And I'm Jim Fleming. We've talked a lot this hour about forgiveness, mostly about how to deal with things that are close to being unforgivable. But you know, forgiving is also something we all do all the time, every day, in fact. You could even say it's bred in our bones. Psychologist Michael McCullough directs the Evolution and Human Behavior Laboratory at the University of Miami. He's written nearly 100 peer-reviewed articles on forgiveness and on revenge and gratitude, as well as a popular book called Beyond Revenge, The Evolution of the Forgiveness Instinct. Clearly, forgiveness is a subject he's thought about a lot.
Some of what keeps me thinking about it is how boring most of it really is. We do it so often, we don't even think about it, and often we wouldn't even dignify it with the term forgiveness. You know, the interactions between my 8-year-old and my 12-year-old, almost on a second-by-second basis, you know, where they're hurting each other's feelings and then sort of effortlessly repairing them and moving on, that is forgiveness.
Do you think there's that it's part of our genetic makeup?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think that human beings, like a lot of social animals, need mechanisms in their heads to restore valuable relationships that get damaged in the course of daily life, scrapping for resources and strategizing for positions in society. Feelings get hurt, relationships get damaged, and lots of animals need ways to repair these relationships. For humans, we call it forgiveness. The evolutionary logic that makes it work is that the individuals with this equipment, this brain equipment that motivates them to forgive, end up with repaired relationships. Our ancestors, ancestral humans, didn't have banks and secure homes and courts of law and attorneys and contracts to protect their interests and to sort of save for the future. They had two things. They had the fat they could store on their bodies, and they had their friends. And those really are your two bank accounts.
Let's look at the other side for a minute, if you will, though. It seems to me that when we feel we've been wronged or harmed, often our first impulse is to get revenge. Does revenge have its own evolutionary history?
Oh, yes, yes. You can look around the animal kingdom. You see very good evidence that if they are harmed by one individual, those harmed individuals will wait for an opportunity to harm the aggressor in kind, to pay them back, if you like.
It's interesting, in some of your research, I think, perhaps particularly among chimpanzees, they take a kind of revenge that is less likely to generate further activity.
There are instances where you find one individual chimpanzee, say, seeking out a relative, looking for an opportunity to harm the nephew. As if to say, I know I can't harm you directly. It would be too anxiety-provoking for me to harm you. You're too powerful. But let me show you that I can get to somebody else that matters to you, and I can harm them. It looks awfully human.
Yeah, but I was just going to say, you can see that happening all the time in human interaction.
Right. It is a very common temptation, and we in the West have worked very hard to erect very big fences around our instincts to prevent those sorts of kin retaliations from happening. Mm-hmm. But it's something that I think we really do inherit from our ancestors as one possible way of righting wrongs or deterring individuals from harming us again.
It does make you wonder, how many generations do you have to spend building those fences around those feelings before those feelings become less prominent?
Well, they can always come up, right? I mean, at a broader societal level, you can have myths and stories about your society that you can resurrect old grievances. Remember that time that other group came in and exterminated, 400 of our villagers?
Right.
You can bring these stories back up hundreds of years later, if you like. So, a lot of the very old wounds that we have as societies can be brought up and resurrected for modern political purposes.
It does make you wonder about the value of history sometimes, doesn't it? So what do you do? What does it take to let go of the desire for revenge and instead offer forgiveness?
I think the thing to realize is that, as a sort of a bedrock truth, that emotions don't exist so we can control them. They exist to control us. When you feel vengeful, it's because there is someone out there in the world who seems to mean you harm, and a mechanism in your head, an instinct, wants you to find a way to deter them from harming you again. So if you want to get over that desire for revenge, what you have to do is change your reality. The reality that turns off revenge is a reality where you realize that the person who harmed you isn't going to harm you again, perhaps wishes you well, and has value to you going forward as a potential relationship partner. So there's two ways we think about this in society. One is we can think about forgiveness as a kind of therapeutic strategy, right? So you can read a book about it.
Kind of over-intellectual, though, don't you think?
It is, right, it is. Sometimes that's all you have at your disposal, though, right? Sometimes you want to forgive somebody who's long gone, somebody you're out of touch with, someone who's died. So you're left to figure this out through your own sort of spiritual searching or, intellectual study. The way the mind evolved to forgive was based on changed realities, though. When you see an offender who is sorry for what they did, has made some overtures to convey to you how sorry they are about it, to convey their intention not to harm you a second time, that's an aggressor that's easy to forgive. The hard forgiveness is when you don't have those changed social realities to work with.
Do we see this in the world of other primates, chimpanzees, for instance? Have you observed acts of forgiveness?
There is something very, very common to group-living non-human animals. It's a behavior that animal researchers call reconciliation. Physical contact, friendly physical contact after a conflict.
It's so almost like those 9-year-old boys being forced to shake hands.
That is exactly what that is. When we shake hands, when we hug, when we send someone a gift, we are making an overture to try to express that you matter to me. I know I harmed you. I think differently about it now. I'd like to take that action back if I could. I know I can't. But what I want to do is communicate to you that you matter to me, and I don't mean you any harm going forward.
What about the other side of it? You go to the coffee shop, you make your amends, you say, I forgive you for the harm you've done, and they say, the harm I've done. What about the harm you've done?
Yeah. Negotiating forgiveness is sometimes very tricky. I actually think that one of the artful parts of being human is figuring out how to take a harm from the past and cover it with so much kindness that you don't even need to talk about forgiveness explicitly. You can start with sending a card or an email, or here's a YouTube clip I thought you would like. And without ever having to go through the clumsy process of sitting down and saying, hey, I forgive you, do you forgive me? and going through all of that uncomfortable stuff, I really do think you can sort of bury a lot of grievances. And maybe that's where we get that turn of phrase, you know, to bury your resentments. Hmm.
Forgiveness might be seen as a weakness, has been, I'm sure, in many societies among many people. Do you think that there are cultures in which it is seen as a stronger act than other cultures?
Some of my favorite, and I think some of the most illuminating cultural examples of revenge and forgiveness come from cultures where there's a very, very strong emphasis on personal honor. I think a good cue that you're in a society that's very focused on honor is a society in which men wear hats. If men wear hats, you're in an honor culture. And in those societies, revenge tends to be really highly valued.
Is taking your hat off an act of forgiveness?
Taking your hat off is an act of humility. That's why we tip our hats, right? That is what tipping your hat is really about. And that's why I think you follow the hats, you find the honor cultures. So in those societies, forgiveness tends to be a more formal enterprise. In societies more like typical Western European, North American societies, we don't talk about honor so much. As a matter of fact, we talk more about dignity. And dignity is not something that can be taken away from you quite so easily through someone else's actions. So you can actually do a little bit more forgiving in sort of the interior of your soul. You don't have to require the same pound of flesh.
We've talked about society. We've talked about culture. What about the individual? What on a personal level? What can I do to bring more forgiveness into my life?
Focusing on benefits, actually, is one of them. It feels to us and it looks to us like a sort of second best to those really fundamentally changed realities of your relationship with the person who harmed you. But if you can't change those realities, thinking about how you might have grown stronger or developed new kinds of strengths from a harm you've suffered, there's a consolation there that can certainly ease the desire for revenge and increase peace about a harm you've encountered in the past.
Michael, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Michael McCullough directs the Evolution and Human Behavior Laboratory at the University of Miami. He's the author of Beyond Revenge, The Evolution of the Forgiveness Instinct. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, Charles Monroe Kane, and Stephanie Youngblood. Joe Hartke remixed this week's theme. Thanks to our technical director, Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson.
PRI, Public Radio International.